Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks again for putting up with my voice and all your suggestions for what kind of tea, what kind of soup, your nice words of various kinds. We will get through this for another 40 minutes and happily with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. You know, when Donald Trump sat down with a room full of people from the Times last week, Tom Friedman was one of the lead questioners. He asked about climate policy. He asked about Syria, other things, and he got some answers that he found encouraging, considering that Friedman has written that the election of Trump could be a big step toward actually breaking our country. He used that word. And yet Tom Friedman is an optimist, as reflected by the title of his new book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in an Age, the Age of Accelerations. He joins us now to brief us on the age of accelerations and debrief us on the interview with the president-elect. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, great to be with you.
And let me start on the news, because you asked the question in the Times interview that got Trump to say he's got an open mind on climate change and the Paris Climate Accords, after calling climate change a hoax during the campaign. Do you think it was really new?
I really don't know. And as I said in my column, stay tuned. I have no idea. It was important for me to, you know, let me step back just one step, Brian, and say, you know, for the last 15 months, I did everything I could to prevent him from being elected president. I also believe that the fact that he has been elected is the most reckless act that the American people have done in my 63 years. Will it turn out better than I hope? For the country's sake, I hope so. I may be spending the next 4 years trying to oppose every single thing he does. I don't know. But in the interregnum here, while he's still forming his cabinet, and because what you see when you interact with him is that he is a man who learns not by reading anything in depth, but by the people he talks to. And then when you realize that for 15 months, because no one thought he was going to win, the people he attracted were basically extremists and some quite knuckleheaded people, that now that he's at least opening himself up to a wider group of people, it's important for me to see in my own little way if by getting him to think about these things, and hopefully he's getting exposed to different voices, that he begins to moderate some positions. Will it be? I just don't know.
Yeah, and I don't know, even based on the answer that he gave you, because even though what broke out as a news story is that he says he has an open mind on climate change, he also said, quote, a lot of smart people disagree with you.
Yeah.
And he referred to people who say climate science on one side, but also those horrible emails sent between the scientists. So I read that as he is equally open to the deniers as a legitimate side of an argument.
Well, you know, Brian, a friend of mine wrote me after the interview, and he pointed out that there's a very fine line between an open mind and no mind. And I think that's one of the real questions we have here. But it's clear by the things he said and that you just quoted, his head has been filled with all of this stuff. And because we had multiple editors and reporters there, I could ask one question,
sure,
Could really follow up. But what I wanted to say was, you are about to be the boss of the two of the greatest bodies of scientists in the world, NASA and NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. And before you make any decisions, could you actually sit down with them and actually get their view? Because it's clear his head's been filled with all this other stuff.
Yeah. You asked him the question in terms of the effects on his golf courses. Was that to put the abstraction of climate change in terms of something concrete and grassy that he cares about?
Absolutely. You're dealing with someone who is not embedded in the science at all. You can't talk to him about really CO2 and its effect. So the point I made in a column, which he said he read, was that he owns many oceanfront golf courses, and they are going to be ocean floor golf courses if we get anywhere near the sea level rise that's predicted. We're already getting flooding in Miami due to sea level rise, and he owns Doral, which will be affected. And He then boasted that his golf courses have received many environmental awards. And so to me, it's all who knows. I mean, I make absolutely no predictions. I just feel like we're in a somewhat plastic moment with him now. And I think there's one thing, and I said this in my column, that he is vastly underestimating. And that is the ferocity of the response of not only the environmental community, but the vast majority of young Americans who have now grown up with the science, anyone past eighth grade science. If he were actually to turn America around, make us the world's leading climate-denying nation at the government level, rather than the leader trying to mitigate climate change, I don't think he understands the ferocity of the response. And let's remember, if he goes to Europe, he will not be able to get out of his car because there are real green parties in Europe, not like the one we have here.
By the way, he responded that some of his golf courses, and I think he mentioned Doral,
yeah,
might be better off. Was that just a joke?
He meant that you could play all year round, you know, so if you have a golf course in the Northern Hemisphere.
Right. Okay.
And I think that's what he meant. God knows what he meant.
So in the context of your book, and listeners, my guest is Tom Friedman, and you can call in with your questions. They don't all have to be about Donald Trump and climate change. 212-433-WNYC. In the context of your book, you see climate change as one of the big three accelerations rocking our world faster and faster. Is there more to this than we even think we know?
Definitely in my view. You know, the core thesis of Thank You for Being Late is that we're in the middle actually of three accelerations all at the same time with the three largest forces on the planet, which I call the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law. So the market is globalization, but not your grandfather's globalization, Brian. It's digital globalization, the globalization of Twitter, Facebook, PayPal. Everything is being digitized and globalized. Moore's Law is named after Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, that the speed and power of microchips will double every roughly 24 months. Now it's probably closer to 30 months. Never mind. It's actually held up for over 50 years. That's also accelerating the pace of technological change. And Mother Nature is climate change, biodiversity loss, and population. It's also accelerating. And these three accelerations are interacting. More Moore's Law drives more globalization. More globalization drives more climate change and potential solutions. And these three accelerations, they're not just changing our world, they're reshaping it. And so the chapter I make on the climate acceleration is built around the ideas of Johan Rockström, who runs the Resilience Institute at the University in Sweden. And Johan basically breaks down our biosphere into 10 sort of boundaries, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere, acidity in the ocean, deforestation. And he treats it almost like a human body. This is your cholesterol level. This is your heart rate. This is your blood pressure. And he basically is estimating each one of those has a boundary. We know, you know, if your body temperature falls to like, I don't know, 70 degrees, you know, you're going to die. If it goes up to 110 degrees, you're going to die. So we know with a human body where our boundaries are. Well, he argues that Mother Nature has those boundaries as well. We just don't know where they are. But he's estimated where they are. And he argues that of the 9 major planetary boundaries, we've retreated from one, the ozone layer, where we've actually improved. 4 others we've already breached. And 4 others were sitting right on the boundary. And therefore, what this Trump administration does is incredibly important.
One of the things you just said was technology is also providing solutions to climate change. And there's an article in the Times today, I think it's by Eduardo Porter, that suggests the growth in natural gas in the U.S. has done more to slow the growth in our carbon emissions than all of President Obama's emissions rules. So could the accelerations in technology that you write about in the book do more to save us from climate change than all the carbon rules that governments might negotiate?
So there's a race here between how these technologies are applied. Because of those technologies, the cost of we are now seeing solar deals around the world in very sun-drenched areas like the Emirates for 3 cents a kilowatt hour. That beats coal, that beats natural gas, that beats anything unsubsidized. So with subsidies, it's 4 or 5 cents. So technology is driving down the cost of wind and solar unfortunately, it's also driven down the cost of fracking and horizontal drilling. And so there's kind of a race between the two. So solar and fracking of natural gas, they're roughly equal now. In the macro, that's good. But what we've learned about fracking is that the emissions of methane in the process, and methane is about 8 times more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2, that it also is a huge problem as well. So ultimately, we want to get, but as a bridge, you know, methane, maybe it's been good. I think, Eduardo, I haven't read the article, but may it be also underestimating. It's also been just the recession, the slowdown in economic growth generally around the world.
You did mention that as another
factor. Which has also really improved the emissions picture.
You ready to take a tough question?
Sure.
Here's David in Hasbrook Heights. David, you're on WNYC with Thomas Friedman. Hi there.
Hi. I've read you for probably over 15 years. And I think your way of thinking is the reason why Hillary lost. You're so highbrow that I don't think you can relate to the average person in America. Maybe in Boston, maybe in Manhattan, probably in L.A. and San Francisco. But, I mean, the average person isn't waking up saying, oh, climate change this or climate change that. The average person is worried about their job, making some money, getting their kids to school, these kind of things. And this is what I don't think you understand, and that is you don't understand the average person out here. And that's the reason Hillary lost. It's not because Trump was brilliant, although he did spend half the money she did. And, you know, it's all this talk about, first of all, the liberals were talking about, oh, he doesn't really have all this money. And now they're all upset. Oh, well, his empire is so big. He's got real estate everywhere. So which one is it? I mean, I like the fact so far, except for Elaine Chao, that he has some business people in his cabinet, somebody that's actually gone out here and built something of value.
David,
and that's what we need in this country.
Thank you very much. Tom, I bet that's not the first time you've heard that critique leveled, maybe not at you as an individual, but at the media as a whole.
You know, I'm someone who's – I'm actually proud of my Trump coverage over the last, you know, 15 months because I never had to eat any bugs on TV. I never predicted that he was going to be gone by August. I took the Trump candidacy very seriously. My actually penultimate column was addressed to precisely the caller's audience. I said that I said I am opposed to Donald Trump. But I am not opposed that I understand where his followers are coming from. So I addressed the column to them. I said he is an indecent person, but I understand what is motivating some of his followers. So, you know, I don't buy the critique at all. And, well, you know, if you're not interested in climate, if you think that's highbrow, if it's going to swamp every coastal city, including New Orleans, there's probably some non-highbrow people who will be affected. At the same time, I know it's maybe an elite thing, but I think it'd be a lot better for the caller's children and other children actually not to be digging in coal mines as a job, but actually maybe installing solar panels and efficiency systems on people's homes. So, I mean, there's kind of this sort of knee-jerk, highbrow. My book is really addressed to and ends up in the community where I grew up in Minnesota. There's a lot of people dining out on the wisdom of all of these people. Read Hillbilly Elegy, you know, I mean, about some of the bad choices, you know, these people have made.
Great so, book by J.D. Vance.
I really, really enjoyed that
book. He was on
book.
The show, comes from Appalachian community and very sympathetic to the people there.
I would just say in closing, you know, when it's highbrow to believe in science, then the end is near.
Diane in Riverdale, you're on WNYC with Thomas Friedman. Hello.
Good morning. Mr. Friedman, you've given me so many facets to my thinking, and I really appreciate you. This is a little off the climate
go ahead.
Change.
Always. We can talk about anything.
Okay. The carrier deal that Trump just said he made, the keeping half of the jobs here, Do we have any idea what concessions he made that would allow? I mean, Carrier certainly didn't do it out of the goodness of his heart.
That's a very good question. I think the details are just coming out now. Ma'am, I think the actual deal was done by the vice president-elect Pence because it was in his state. And so he had the ability to extend subsidies to Carrier to limit the number of jobs that they are sending abroad. Let me use your very good question to deal more broadly with this whole idea of what will happen to the future of blue-collar labor in this country. And where do I think Trump is really wrong-headed? So if you listen to what Trump says, manufacturing in America is disappearing. I mean, we're just a manufacturing wasteland. In fact, manufacturing is the biggest sector of our economy today. It's grown since China joined the WTO. It's grown since we joined NAFTA. And it's our output either is equal to or maybe even ahead. I don't remember the exact statistics of that of China. We just do it with so many fewer human beings. And that is the central challenge here. The Carrier jobs or these blue-collar jobs, the vast majority of them actually aren't going to Mexico. They're going to a microchip. It's automation. And that's why I quote in the book Warren Bennis, the management consultant's dictum, that the modern American factory really just has two employees, a man and a dog. The man is there to feed the dog, and the dog is there to keep the man away from the machines. That's an exaggeration, but that's the trend of events.
In fact, in the Times interview, when Trump said he's going to keep the factories here, you asked, What if they keep the factories here, but the robots do all the work? And he said, we'll make the robots too, and everyone laughed.
Right.
But you were asking a serious question.
Very serious question. And we'll make the robots, too, with robots, okay? And look, I applaud the idea of trying to get more work for blue-collar and the lesser educated part of the population. But I think there's going to be a limit to that, that the way to actually get that work is not by dreaming of Ford coming back and building a 25,000-person Ford factory in your town, because that factory is now 2,500 people and 500 robots. What we actually need is an explosion of entrepreneurship, of five people creating jobs for seven creating jobs for 12, 12 creating jobs for 20. That's how not only we will fill the gap, but that's actually how we're filling the gap. You know, I was at a conference in the fall, and there was a woman there who I think I've got this right because I haven't been able to check it out. I just heard her say it, that her job was tagging sharks for Twitter. I thought to myself, whoever knew there'd be a job tagging sharks for Twitter? Your kid comes home from college, says, Mom, Dad, I want to tag sharks for Twitter when I grow up. You say to them, you couldn't be an ophthalmologist? I mean, tagging sharks for Twitter? That is – if you keep the economy open and flexible and you try to get everybody a better education, the magic of America will happen. But if you try to preserve, you know, what we had, you know, if horses could have voted, there never would have been cars. We've been in these moments before, and the thing to do is not to pull in. It's to trust the magic of this country by keeping ourselves open. You'll never see the new jobs. You know, every time I'm out speaking about the book, someone comes up to the question line, and they tell me about their job, and it's a job. I say to them, 5 years ago, that job didn't exist. You'd never imagine it, but there they are.
I see, by the way, that you don't tweet.
Yeah.
How come a tech-forward guy like you doesn't tweet?
You know, I am so focused, Brian, on what I am doing in terms of researching and working. And when you sit where I sit at the Times, you're the object of an enormous amount of tweeting, of all kinds of stuff. And I'd rather use my energy talking to the next person and learning from them rather than responding to everybody who writes. So it's that's just my philosophy.
Thomas Friedman is with us. His new book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. By the way, Tom Friedman will also be at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 7:30 if you want to see him in person. We will continue with Tom Friedman and more of your calls right after this. We'll be right back. Ray and Lara on WNYC. We're talking with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman about the New York Times interview with Donald Trump, in which he was a key questioner, and ideas from his new book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. Now, the title, Thank You for Being Late, is a nod to how compressed our lives are these days.
Yeah, it actually comes from meeting people in Washington, D.C. over the years for breakfast. And as a news person, I don't like to waste my breakfast by eating alone. So I like to, you know, schedule different people, idea people who can widen my world and perspective. And about 3 years ago, I was having breakfast with one of them, Brian, and I believe it was Peter Corsell. He's the one who claims it was the first time with him. And he was 15, 20 minutes late. People always come late. They say, Tom, I'm really sorry. It's the weather, the traffic, the subway, the dog ate my homework. And what I said to him just spontaneously was, actually, Peter, thank you for being late. Because you were late, I've been eavesdropping on their conversation. Fascinating. I've been people watching the lobby. Fantastic. And I just connected two ideas I've been struggling with for a month. So thank you for being late. And people started to get into it. They'd say, well, you're welcome. Because they knew I was giving them permission to pause. And, you know, my favorite quote in the front of the book in that chapter is from my friend Dov Seidman, who says, you know, when you press the pause button on a computer, it stops. But when you press the pause button on a human being, it starts. It starts to reflect, to rethink, to reimagine. And the argument of the book is that in this age of acceleration, we need to do so much rethinking and reimagining.
You cite the year 2007. So we're coming to the 10th anniversary of what you see as a pivotal year in human history because of three things: the cloud, the iPhone, and something from a company that's not as much a household name as Google or Apple, Hadoop. What is Hadoop, and how did it change the world in 2007? In fact, how did you even hear about Hadoop?
Let me start with that, your last question. 3 years ago, the head of Walmart asked me if I would be the speaker for their famous Saturday morning meeting in Bentonville. They have once a month a big Saturday morning conclave. I was going to be the warm-up act for Kevin Costner. And you know, the Times doesn't allow us to take money from companies. So I said, look, I will do it. But here's what I want in return. I want you to get your IT team together in Bentonville and show me what happens if I try to buy, we settled on, a 30-inch television off Walmart's mobile app on my iPhone. I said, I want to know what's going on behind the scenes. Show me every step of the way. So they got their IT team together. It was fascinating. And they started explaining to me, well, we did this with GitHub and we did this with Hadoop. And I said, time out. GitHub, Hadoop, what are these? And I realized these were really important companies that I didn't really know anything about. Hadoop's a software, actually. GitHub is the world's biggest open source software platform. So that led me on a journey, Brian, where I started to discover all the things that happened in 2007. What happened? In January 2007, the iPhone came out. Actually, in late 2006, Facebook came out of high schools and universities and was open to anyone in the world. Twitter was founded in 2006, went global in 2007. Airbnb was started in 2007. The Kindle was started in 2007. IBM Watson was started in 2007. Google came out with Android in 2007. Google bought YouTube in 2007. The price of sequencing a human genome collapsed in 2007. The cloud was born in 2007. It turns out 2007 may in time be understood as one of the greatest technological inflection points since Gutenberg.
Let me drill down on one of those, the cloud.
Yeah.
As in storing our data and our photos and everything in the cloud. You put it in the book up there with electricity and fire as something that will fundamentally change human history. Why is that true if all the cloud is basically just a big virtual storage closet?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So first of all, in the book, I never use the word the cloud because it sounds so soft. It sounds so cuddly. It sounds so fluffy. It sounds like a Joni Mitchell song. Sure. I've looked at clouds from both sides. Nah.
No, don't.
This ain't no cloud. I rename it the supernova because I believe this is actually now the core energy source that's driving your radio station, your business, your education. It's really at the center of everything. So what basically happened in 2007 was this combination of the smartphone, which put a handheld computer in the palm of now probably half the people on the planet, heading for everybody, then gave us the bandwidth to connect them to the cloud from anywhere. And then this thing we call the cloud, this energy source, that the combination of those three changed four kinds of power, Brian. Changed the power of one. Wow, what one person can do now is amazing. As a maker or a breaker, Donald Trump can sit in his penthouse at 6 a.m. in the morning and with a few swipes of a phone, communicate basically with literally a couple billion people. The power of machines has changed. Machines now, they can think. They're really developing all five senses. The power of ideas has changed. Ideas now flow and change at a pace we've never seen before. Barack Obama 5 years ago said marriage is between a man and a woman. Today, he says marriage is between two human beings who love each other, blessedly so, and he's following Ireland in that position. So we're seeing ideas change, and it's changing the power of many. We as a collective are now a force of and in nature, so significant that the new geological era is being named after us, the Anthropocene. That's what the cloud is driving.
Anthro, human beings, yeah. Impact on the planet.
Exactly.
Enrique in Nutley, you're on WNYC with Thomas Friedman. Hello. Enrique, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Got you now. Hi.
Well, thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment, actually. It's a funny thing. I think that we today have the technology to improve our lives and make it a lot cheaper, but yet we don't use that technology. For example, in third world countries, you will see a lot of solar systems. It's not that they are more modern than we are. It's because it's a lot cheaper. You will also find cell phones all over the place in places where they had no communication before. It's not that the cell phones, you know, are more advanced. It's that it's a lot cheaper to use a cell phone than it is to actually build an infrastructure of wires and power lines and everything. Yet we don't do it here. We were so slow to adopt solar systems in public highways and lights everywhere, because we simply have a very different culture. Our culture is really very profit-driven, which really is greed-driven. You know, we don't let other alternatives come in because we're trying to make money. We don't realize that if we actually were to make our lives cheaper, we don't necessarily have to raise all the salaries, you know, a lot more. So there's two ways of getting to that point.
Well, Enrique makes a good point. I think, though, I would just differ a little bit on the explanation. What happened was because these developing countries had no legacy systems, as he said, they went from no phones to cell phones. They didn't go to rotary dials. We were stuck with a lot of rotary dial phones that went ringy-dingy. They also went from no, you know, electricity systems or very crude ones to directly to solar and skipped over, in some cases, baseload coal. So in some ways, their lack of development was an advantage because they were able to quickly adopt the new technology and skip over the legacy systems we have been stuck with.
Back to the Trump interview with the New York Times. You asked him about Russia, and I thought his answer in terms of Syria was contradictory but fascinating. Yeah. We have this clip in which he mocks the Bush policy of endless war and mocks Lindsey Graham for saying we need a big troop buildup in Syria. But he also says we have to solve that problem so we don't keep fighting forever. Here's a minute of Trump with Tom Friedman and the New York Times team.
Syria, we have to solve that problem because we're just going to keep fighting forever. I have a different view on Syria than everybody else. Not everybody else, but than a lot of people. I had to listen to Lindsey Graham, who... Give me a break. I don't listen to Lindsey Graham talk about, you know, attacking Syria and attacking, you know, and it's like, you're now attacking Russia, you're attacking Iran, you're attacking, and what are we getting? What are we getting? And I have some very definitive, and I have some very strong ideas on Syria. I think what's happened is a horrible, horrible thing. It's to look at the deaths, and I'm not just talking deaths on our side. which are horrible. But the deaths, I mean, you look at these cities, Arthur, where they're totally, they're rubble, massive areas of, and they say two people were injured. No, thousands of people have died, okay? I think it's a shame. And
can you describe that?
I can only say this. We have to end that craziness that's going on in Syria.
We have to end that craziness that's going on in Syria after mocking Lindsey Graham earlier for wanting a troop buildup there. Was there a there to that answer, or was he just rambling?
You know, you never know, and I don't pretend to be able to say so definitively, Brian, but, you know, Syria is the problem from hell. What one can say is actually what Barack Obama and John Kerry are trying to do right now is actually pretty close to what Trump is talking about. They have been negotiating with Putin to try to create a transition arrangement that will stop the war, provide a safe haven for the opposition, and maybe a one-year-long transition process that ultimately would end with Assad leaving. I think what Trump will discover is that the Iranians and the Russians aren't just interested in ending the killing there. They're interested in the killing on terms that will allow what has been a genocidal dictator who took a democracy movement and tried to turn it into basically a jihad and then produced a jihad in some ways against him. And he's going to find this is a lot harder than sitting down with Putin and saying, you take Aleppo, I take Damascus, you know, everybody will be happy. We split it here. We put a Trump Tower in Latakia. Everything's fine. It's going to be much more complicated than that.
And I'm also trying to figure out if he's interventionist or not interventionist.
I would say in his gut, first of all, I don't think he's sorted that out. I think his gut is less interventionist than more, because I asked him another question on that. And the first thing he said was, I'm against nation building. So here's what and I deal with this. I have a chapter in the book called Control versus Chaos. It's taken from the 60s sitcom Get Smart with Don Adams. And if you remember that Don Adams was a spoof secret agent working like James Bond, and the agency he worked for, Brian, was called Control. And their worldwide enemy was called Chaos, spelled K-A-O-S. And I believe the authors of that show were way ahead of their time, because what I argue in the book is these three accelerations are actually plowing through a whole host of countries, creating a vast zone of disorder, basically from West Africa through North Africa, right up to the border of India. And the relevant dividing line in the world today is no longer east, west, north, south, communist, capitalist. It's actually between the world of order and the world of disorder. And the Mediterranean is now the dividing line. So what happens and what Trump will discover when he comes in is that I literally have a section in the book called Mama, Don't Let Your Daughters Grow Up to Be Secretaries of State. Brian, it's going to be the worst job in the world. If Trump calls you and says, Brian, I want you to be Secretary of State, you tell him you had your heart set on agriculture, okay? Because it's going to be an incredibly difficult job.
I think that's one problem I'm not going to have. But to your larger point, you call in the book for moral innovation. Can there be moral innovation? Or are progressives doomed to always think they can change human nature when they can't?
Really good question. I try to... Well, the basic architecture of the book is the first part's about the accelerations, and the second part is about how these accelerations are reshaping the world. And so I go through it's reshaping geopolitics, as we just talked about. It's reshaping politics, reshaping the workplace, reshaping community, and reshaping ethics. And that's what you're raising. And one of the other callers alluded to this. So the chapter is called Is God in Cyberspace? And it comes from a question I got 20 years ago on book tour in Portland, Oregon. A man stood up and said, Mr. Friedman, is God in cyberspace? And I said, I don't know. I've never been asked that question before. So what I tell the story that I actually called my rabbi, Tzvi Marx. He's in Amsterdam, great Talmudic scholar. I said, Tzvi, I got a question I've never had before. Is God in cyberspace? What should I have said to this guy? And he said, you know, in our faith tradition, we have two concepts of the Almighty, a biblical and a post-biblical view. The biblical view says God is – he's almighty. He smites evil and rewards good. And if that's your view of God, he sure isn't in cyberspace, which is full of pornography, gambling, cheating, lying, fake news, and bad talk. But he said, fortunately, we have a post-biblical view of the Almighty, which said says God manifests himself by how we behave. So if we want God to be in cyberspace, we have to bring him there by how we behave there. Why did I put that in this book, Brent? Because, and you really saw it in this election, because everything's now moving to cyberspace, where we meet friends, where we meet our wives or future husbands, how we communicate, how we do commerce, how we educate. And what's happening, everything is moving to this realm where we're all connected, but no one's in charge. And therefore, and you really felt it in this election, what values prevail in cyberspace is starting to really matter more and more.
We have about a minute left. I'm going to ask you a random question that I thought of knowing you were coming in. The Service Employees Union leader, Andy Stern, was here for his book this year, which suggests that automation, and I thought of this because you write so much about the acceleration of technology in the book, automation is now proceeding so quickly and irreversibly that the only way to compensate is with a guaranteed national income, like a negative income tax, because there will no longer be as many decent incomes as there are people, no matter what Donald Trump or anybody else tries to do. Maybe that's a pessimist's guide to the age of accelerations, but does he have a point?
He has a point. I address that in the book. We may need to have a national basic income, but before we get there, I much prefer the earned income tax credit to reward people to top up their wages who are working, because I think work is so essential to anchor you in the world, giving you an identity, giving you a sense of self-worth, that just paying people to stay home I think could be socially very unhealthy over time. So I really hope that we can rather – and I'm much more optimistic than Andy Stern that we will find jobs. You'll never see them coming.
New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman – his new book is called Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. And Thomas Friedman will be at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 7:30 if you want to see him in person and hear more. Thank you very much for coming in, Tom. It's good to see you in person.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
And listeners, again, thanks for putting up with my voice today after I woke up with this sore throat and came in and limped along. So many remedies coming in on Twitter. Boiled garlic with lime and honey, zinc and echinacea, chicken soup. Somebody had to say that. Cinnamon and chamomile. So keep the remedies coming. Thank you for all your good wishes. I have a feeling there'll be a guest host here tomorrow, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.